Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in French Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roxanne Penchassi. My guest in this episode is Nicholas Harrison, the author of Our Civilizing Mission, The Lessons of Colonial Education. And the book was published by Liverpool University Press in 2019. Hi there, Nick.
Hi, Roxanne. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. Before we get started, Nick, can I just ask you, to tell us about where you are and how this past year now of global pandemic has been treating you?
Well, I'm in London. I work in London at King's College. I've had my ups and downs during the pandemic, like lots of people, I suppose. It hasn't been all bad for me personally or my immediate family, but there have been some difficult moments for sure. And the current phase of lockdown, certainly my children have found it very hard this time around. They're both supposed to be doing exams this year, and that's all been a mess. Yeah, and it's been hard as well. This is the first time I've spoken to anyone about my research for about a year as well. So it's been very hard work in the university this last year.
I can imagine. And yeah, I think some of the authors that I've spoken to, depending on when their books came out, they just haven't had a chance to think about their previous research, let alone think about doing anything new or making any kind of part. And I feel the same way. So, I completely relate to what you're saying about that. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what got you interested originally in working on the French colonial world?
Well, I studied French and German as an undergraduate. The third year was spent abroad by everyone. I had traveled very little really growing up for various reasons. Hadn't spent much time at all in France, but there was the possibility of going to Tunisia. I just sort of saw that box on the form, and I'd never been outside of Europe. And that sounded interesting. And I thought, I might get other chances in my life to go to Paris for the year, but I probably won't get another chance to live in Tunis for a year. So that's what I did. I applied for that and I spent a year in Tunisia, and that was a very important experience for me and got me very interested in the Maghreb and in the whole, the history of empire and the Francophone world in general. And actually the year after I graduated, I wasn't sure if I was going to go on to a PhD. The Tunisian year had been wonderful. So I actually applied for a job in Dakar, and didn't get it, and instead was offered a job on the Gaspé Peninsula in Quebec, which may mean something to you, although it's several thousand miles away from where you are in Canada. That also, sustained and sort of broadened my interest in the Francophone world and in empire. I didn't work on that material at all at PhD level. At that time, I hadn't studied it at all as an undergraduate. No one taught it. I was at Cambridge. No one taught that stuff. Had no opportunity there at all. I was interested in other things too, of course. I did a PhD about censorship, but it wasn't about Algeria, which it could have been, of course. It was more about kind of moral censorship. And then what happened was I got a research fellowship. I'd been in Paris actually then for a couple of years. I got a research fellowship back in Cambridge. And I don't want to say I lied about what I intended to do with my postdoctoral project, but I wasn't completely honest about it. And I always intended to sort of start working on post-colonial and Francophone material then. And the reason I wasn't open about it was that I didn't think I had enough to say about it at that point because I hadn't studied it formally. But once I was in, that's what I started doing. And I'd read quite a lot of post-colonial theory. I'd read a certain amount of Francophone literature. And I started work on that area really because I was interested in post-colonial studies and because I thought this was something I wanted to teach in the end, because no one around me was teaching it. So that was really where it all started for me.
That's an interesting trajectory. And this focus on colonial education, how did that come about? How did you decide to write this book or start the project that became this book?
Well, I mean, what I've worked on has been quite eclectic in some ways, and I've worked on film as well. You and I first had contact in relation to the Battle of Algiers, I remember, many years ago now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always been interested in, you know, the kind of political work that literature and film do in the world, I suppose, and how people have understood that. And of course, censorship's one version of that. Censors have a view about that, and anti-censors do too. Postcolonial critics have theories about that, both sort of implicit and explicit, which is what my second book was about in a sense. But then we're all of us teachers as well as academics in the humanities. And, you know, we're active agents in that process as well, in shaping who reads what and how they react to it or what they view and so on, if they're studying film. It's another version of that. This is not necessarily how I initially thought of it. It's more that I realized that this is something that's unified a lot of what I've done. I suppose it's also, I mean, I could situate it in two other ways. I mean, one is just simply that a lot of what I teach is Francophone literature from the Maghreb, and especially from Algeria. Increasingly, I got drawn more and more into Algeria in a way that a lot of people in our field would understand. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of that literature, whether it's fiction or autobiography or diaries and so on, turns on the educational experiences of the North African writers who were made into French-speaking writers by their education, you know, so that work is constantly reflecting back on that. So I just, at a certain point, that just struck me as such a central issue in so much of what I was reading, even though I had never kind of organized things thematically in that way. And then the final thing I'd say, I suppose, was that I was drawn into it as a way of thinking about teaching in the humanities and teaching literature, even, you know, teaching French literature when it's a foreign literature for most of your students, you know, that I started to think there were parallels, strange parallels in a sense between the colonial situation and my situation. And in the context of, in a context where the humanities and something like French discipline can feel a bit beleaguered. So it's a way to reflect on those things too. And on my own practice as a teacher, you know, and as someone who writes about this stuff as well.
I think one of the things that I find most fascinating about your book, Nick, is that, you know, I saw it when it arrived and I thought I knew what it was going to be about. And it is about those things in some ways, but I hadn't anticipated the ways that it would make me think more broadly about education. And what it made me realize was that walking into your book, that I had an idea of what you mean by colonial education and what the boundaries of that are. And I think the book really opens up the question of colonial education in relationship to education more broadly. Could you say if I'm right about that, but also could you say a little bit about how that works throughout the book?
Yes. Well, you are right about that. And I'm very pleased to hear you say that. On one level, of course, it's a book that tries to be about colonial education and about the specificities of colonial education, and particularly in the Algerian context, and particularly as lived by specific people who've then written about those experiences. But as I was suggesting just now, I also always wanted to think about colonial education as an example of education as well, if I can put it like that. So there's I suppose the obvious way to approach it through post-colonial studies, which in a sense where I've come in from, but perhaps also as a historian, which is not my discipline, is thinking of colonial education as an example of colonialism, a facet of colonialism. So again, I wanted to deal with that side of things, to talk about that, try to cast light on that, but I also wanted to treat it as an example of education. So a very, you know, an extreme and uncomfortable example of education, but that forces us to confront some of the issues about the normative thrust of what we do, and the sense in which as teachers we're making choices about what our students read, and the faith we have to have, I suppose, at some level that we're doing them good by forcing them to read these things. So I'm putting that all rather crudely, but there's a common ground there at a certain point that I was trying to explore, and a lot of that I frame things in such a way, for example, through talking about Said and so on, and we may talk more about that, I suppose, later, that tries to show that I want to open it up. But a lot of the time, I suppose I think some of the most important things I want the book to do, I want it to do implicitly through making people think about parallels and points of comparison outside my immediate subject matter.
Yeah, I mean, I guess another way of saying phrasing my awkward question would be to say, I didn't expect to be implicated in your book. And I felt that way, not in maybe sometimes in an uncomfortable way, but, you know, discomfort isn't always a bad thing. I hadn't expected to think about my own role as an educator and what I do and what choices I make quite as intensely as I did, you know, approaching your book, thinking that I was going to read about something well outside, you know, what I do and what I think about. So yeah, it was that experience and, you know, of reading the book is really quite interesting.
Well, that's great. That's music in my ears.
Well, it makes it a very different book, I think, than, you know, other pieces that I've read that do focus on, as you put it, you know, colonial education as a facet of colonialism or an aspect of colonialism or one of the tools or something. So that's there in this book, but there's something else there that we've just been talking about. So, and I do want to talk about the, you know, different chapters and, you know, including that first one on Said. But before we talk about them in kind of detail, I wonder if you could just sort of say something broadly about, when getting into this, how you thought about the parameters of this project. You know, I am a historian, so of course I'm going to ask you about, like, you know, periodization and things like that, how you think about the role of past and present in this project, and also just, you know, the different types of materials that you're working with, reading, responding to in the book, how those things came together and how you think about them throughout the project.
Well, a lot of what I teach is material, particularly fiction, I suppose, from the late colonial period in Algeria. So some of it's relatively early Francophone literature, but that only really starts to emerge in a fairly substantial way in the 1950s. In a sense, that's the kind of heart of the material. And in some ways that remained true to the end of the project, although that material only really starts to feature very centrally in the fourth and fifth of the five central chapters. I don't go beyond the moment of independence, really, in general. I mean, of course, some of the material that I'm talking about is published long after independence, but it's reflecting back on that period. And that's to do with my focus on colonialism. It's to do also, I suppose, with the limits of my knowledge of Arabic. I mean, I have studied that, but I'm more self-conscious and inhibited about trying to study the post-independence era because my Arabic is so utterly poor.
Than mine. I'm just starting.
Well, yeah, I found it very hard. I mean, it was an interesting lesson too, discovering how hard I found it. Yeah, and it's also, I think, that in post-colonial Francophone literary field, which is kind of my home territory, I think a majority of people now, you know, work on very recent material, and there's a kind of pressure in that direction. So I was interested to go back to this kind of formative moment in the sense of the emergence of this literature. More broadly in the book, in the end, it comes back to your question about the kind of duality of the project, if I can put it like that. I mean, I wanted to have a core of material that was circumscribed basically as Algerian. There are exceptions to that, but the core material is Algerian and from that period I was just describing, so that I could get a reasonably sort of, well, so that I felt I had a reasonable command of the historical context and could talk about things in a historicized way, or at least not talk about things in a way that would seem naive or misleading to historians. Mm-hmm. I mean, historians are, you know, figures who provoke anxiety in me.
I hope I'm not doing that right now.
Well, it could be worse.
They provoke anxiety in me, if that's at all.
Well, that's consoling.
Any consolation?
the second chapter in the end has a much broader historical sweep, as you'll have seen. But what I didn't, I worried for a long time about what to do with that and whether to try to offer an overall narrative of colonial education in Algeria, you know, from the beginning of the conquest through to 1962. And I didn't try to do that in the end. I felt there were other places that people could go for that, that it, you know, been done well enough elsewhere already in both English and French. And I didn't need to offer that. People couldn't find that elsewhere. And instead of which I just took moments out of that history in a way that's very sort of undisciplined in terms of historiography, but to draw out some of the idiosyncrasies and inconsistencies within that history, which were important to what I wanted to do here. So it tries to give some sense of the longer history, but I would say, I mean, there's a sense in which the central chapter three, which I think is my favorite chapter, is the one that's most tightly focused on a particular figure and a particular moment. Mm-hmm. And I've said that, and that's in the heart of that sort of chronological period in the 50s that I was talking about just now.
Well, Nick, I certainly don't speak on behalf of historians in general, but I appreciated that about the book, that it, you know, references and touches on things, but it's not recapitulating work that we already have on the history of colonial education. It's sort of moving in other directions from that work, or at least that's how I understood the book. That first chapter on Said that revisits Orientalism, you know, thinks about Said as an educator, thinks about politics and literature. I mean, it's fascinating for me because, sure, I think about Said, you know, he comes up a bunch, but I haven't really spent time sort of focusing on Said's thought. And then you're doing this other set of things and asking these sort of different questions. Could you talk about that sort of decision to focus on Said in that first chapter, but then also how you're hoping to, you know, use Said for your purposes, but also maybe contribute to what people have to say about him in a larger kind of obsessive body of debate and discussion about Said and what Said meant and
yes, sure.
to us, what he really meant, you know, all that.
Yeah, I mean, I started with that material partly, of course, just because I would view him, as many people would, as a foundational figure for the entire space in which a project like this is taking place, post-colonial studies, so-called post-colonial studies, that particular kind of attempt to think about the place of literature in relation to the historical phenomenon of colonialism and in relation to the discourses around it and so on. So all of that, you know, this is in a sense where I came from and came into this material from. It's also a way of then of trying to create these connections and resonances for people at the start who may not be familiar with the Algerian material particularly, or certainly not with all of the figures that I talk about, but to put it in a wider framework in that way. But it's also, I treat Said in the book as, I go back to the issues about his relationship to literature, that he, you know, he was a scholar of comparative literature. He seemed to be, you know, very comfortable with that affiliation, as it were, in many ways. That's where he taught. That was his primary disciplinary affiliation. Post-colonial studies as an economic phenomenon was based mainly in, you know, has been based mainly in English departments, complete departments, kind of, you know, literature and language departments and so on. Of course, mm-hmm. there were all kinds of overlaps with history, but I mean, colonial history was already an ongoing thing in history departments before this became such a big deal in literature departments, if I can put it like that. One of the very common criticisms of Said was has concerned his sort of equivocations around canonical literature, associated with the fact partly that he seemed, you know, he remains very attached to it, that he obviously, after Orientalism, he started to broaden out. He took that criticism on board to a degree, tried to sort of broaden his scope, look more at writing from former colonies and so on. But I think a lot of critics have seen that as a kind of weak spot, and in a sense, one that might be explained by his own colonial education, in a sense, I talk about his critical work, but I also talk about his memoir Out of Place in the book. And I suppose I want to look at that from a slightly different angle and see his hesitation around these issues as quite well-founded methodologically, in a sense, that I see him as hesitating for quite good reasons simply to brand certain literary texts as Orientalist in a way that's indistinguishable from other Orientalist texts. Now, that's not to say it doesn't make sense to call them Orientalist if you're talking about people like, you know, Flaubert or Nerval, some of the French writers that he's attached to and that he talks about. Mm-hmm. But he hesitates over whether they are have the same sort of ideological culpability, if I can put it like that, that he sees in other Orientalist writers, and including administrators and so on. And one of the characteristics of his writing there is to have these big long lists that cut across genres and link literature to all these other forms. And again, that's been very important to the development of the discipline. Mm-hmm. But part of him still wants to give kind of special treatment to literature. And I'm trying to say he's maybe has some good reasons for that still. And so, and that's addressed in that first chapter primarily as a methodological issue in relation to the relationship, I suppose, between literary criticism and history, say, and also adjacent disciplines such as politics. And I come back to it more later in the concluding chapter in relation to questions of pedagogy.
I just want to kind of follow up a tiny bit, Nick, on this, the question of, you know, I guess I hadn't really thought about, even though I feel like Said is part of my own education, I hadn't really thought about a few of these different figures that you look at in the book, you know, as educators, you know, like, of course, that makes perfect sense. And I guess I wonder what that turn is for you. So there's the idea of Said's colonial education, but then the idea of thinking about Said as an educator, like, where did that sort of turn come from? And what's the consequence of asking that question?
Well, I think, I suppose, in a way, again, I want to cast light on the relationship between different facets of his career as a public intellectual, you know, and a political figure, as a scholar of comparative literature, and then as an educator. And so part of that first chapter is about looking at his promotion of the role of the public intellectual. Now, I admire the work he did in that sphere, and I see myself as sharing his political attitudes in that sphere. But I think there's another hesitation in his work is over the relationship between that work and his day job, as it were, which is the teaching of comparative literature. And that there's something perverse about trying to justify, you know, and ground the work of the literary, you know, the teacher of literature, by saying, well, you can spend some of your time doing something else, which is a kind of political advocacy, without it being clear why you need to do the teaching work at all. Why would you do that? You could spend all your time on the advocacy, if that's the real deal, as it were, if that's the more important work. You know, in a way, I'm wanting to draw out some of the tensions there. And in this, I feel I'm speaking to people like me, whose day job is as teachers and as people who think about books and ideas and films and so on, and who don't have direct access to the corridors of power, and in a sense have chosen a career that makes that kind of access difficult, even if one might wish to have it. So it's a question about the justifications of spending one's time on this sort of marginal and kind of luxurious form of education when, you know, when you, from a political point of view, there are other things you could be doing that would be certainly more direct and might appear more effective.
Yeah, see, and again, I feel implicated. Like, this is what I mean, is like throughout the book, I kept coming back to that question of what are you doing with your life, Roxanne? Which I know you didn't mean the book to be addressed to me in particular, but yeah, I think that comes up again and again. Not that I would put myself anywhere near the company of Said, but that you know, just that question of, you know, how to do and teach, especially canon, right? Which I sometimes do. You know, my ambivalence about that, all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, it makes sense to come at that question through Said's work, right? But I hadn't ever thought, I guess, about coming at that question through the fact that Said's work is also connected to Said teaching the literature. I hadn't thought about that part of his career, in fact, ever, I think, before, that, you know, thought about him as a teacher, even though I think of the text as teaching me and teaching all of us, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes, yeah, exactly. But I talk about some of his very well-known texts, including Orientalism, including the memoir, but there are some less well-known interviews and essays and so on that I draw on where he talks about his work as an educator. And he's apt, as I think perhaps you or I would be too, to disavow that work in the sense of saying, well, of course, I'm not a specialist in education. I'm not, you know, this isn't my field, to make these comments about that when he's talking about pedagogy, even though that is the absolute core of what he does and shapes quite fundamentally his relationship to the material that he talks about. I first read Orientalism and the World, the Text and the Critic on a literary theory course, you know, and that was the context in which I came into it. And these, the initial arguments that I sort of go over here, as I say, are kind of literary theoretical ones in a sense. Mm. And I'm trying to explain why, from that perspective, why you may have reasons to hesitate over what to do with this canonical literature, particularly whether it's still worthy of attention at all, or whether it's just recirculating ideological toxins, you know, and be better abandoned, to put it crudely. And it struck me at a certain point that a perhaps simpler and perhaps more compelling way to explain his hesitations is that this is the stuff that he teaches. Mm. And that if you're going to make your students spend their time on it, you know, given also the disproportion between the time they spend with the book and the time they spend with you, you better not think that they spend all that time reading their Flaubert in order for you just to tell them at the end of it, oh, well, it's, you know, there are these problems with it ideologically that maybe should be part of what you talk about. But you have to think the book's doing something on its own of value, it seems to me, as they read it. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so you've got to have a more complex notion of what it does, how it acts on people. And I think at some level, to come back to something I said earlier, you've got to have some kind of faith that there's something positively educational about just the encounter with that book, despite aspects of it that you may find problematic or reprehensible ideologically from today's perspective.
The second chapter of the book, Nick, is maybe the most like what I thought I was going to read, in the sense that, you know, I think it covers some of the terrain that I thought the whole book would be about. The emphasis in that chapter at least starts out as sort of thinking through the range of strategies and some of the like internal contradictions or unevenness of, you know, colonial education in the colonial context and what colonial educators, the strategies that they used to, in some cases, be more responsive to like local context, to the life experiences and backgrounds and cultural differences of their students, that kind of thing. So what are you doing in that chapter with respect to opening up how we think about colonial education and kind of emphasizing the problems inherent in that system?
In that chapter, I mean, in a way, I suppose my starting point in a sense was what I saw as background assumptions about French colonial education, less perhaps in those who are actually really working on that as such than among those who touched on it in the context of wider discussions of colonialism. Mm. So that, I mean, Said would be another example there. In a sense, education's everywhere in his writing, but he says very little about it actually in his main publications. Mm. So you mean that you could think that could easily be central to an account of the way that Orientalist texts were propagated. You know, their ideology was propagated through the text, through educational institutions, but he doesn't talk about it. And so I think there's often this background assumption about how colonial education is working, you know, that it's a tool of colonialism and a dimension of the mission civilisatrice, you know, in the French context, mm-hmm. an attempt to impose French culture, that it's condescending towards colonial students, to put it mildly and euphemistically, I mean, you know, racist, discriminatory, mm-hmm. And oblivious to their identities. And that phrase, nous ancêtres les Gaulois, is the emblem of that, this famous phrase, you know, that crops up in textbooks from the Third Republic onwards, and, you know, that's delivered to students, irrespective of who they are and who their ancestors might be, and irrespective of what their own ancestral myths might be, you know, in different corners of the French Empire, and for that matter, in different corners of France as well. And again, these are widespread assumptions, and I'm not saying these are wrong, but these are the kind of primary assumptions, as it were. And then the other thing at the same time would be that there's wide recognition that many leading anti-colonial figures went through colonial education, including in the Algerian case, many of the leaders of the FLN, which was quite a Francophone organization. I mean, El Mujahid, their main journal, was, you know, there was a French edition quite a while before there was an edition in Arabic. Mm-hmm. And there were reasons for that to do with sort of intended and imagined readership and so on, but it was also to do with the educational background of many of those people. And I think that's often registered as a kind of a paradox, if you like. These anti-colonial leaders were made what they were by a colonial education. But I suppose I didn't want to leave it at that. It doesn't seem enough to think of it as a paradox. And it's not enough either to think of it as a kind of unintended consequence, I don't think, because I think you then need to think, well, in what sense is it actually a consequence of that education? But you also need to think then about what you understand about the intentions, you know, and that notion of the intentions of colonial education starts to get much more complex as soon as you look at the material in more detail. And so in a sense, what I do in this chapter is to start with examples that support those founding assumptions, which may be the predominant ones for good reasons, you know, the kind of weaponization, as people say now, of education. But you also see all kinds of very strange inconsistencies in that history when you start to look more closely. So I quite often see people saying, you know, people were never allowed to study Arabic in colonial schools or to speak it, but that wasn't always true. The French state put money into madrasas, and, you know, bilingual madrasas, and did so well into the era of laïcité. And there were always these fierce debates among colonizers about the risks of offering education to the colonized, because there were, I mean, in a sense, quite well-founded anxieties about the effects that would have on the colonized, mm-hmm. that it would give them, you know, it would give them ideas, it would make them articulate, it would make them feel in a position to make political claims and so on. So it's just not true that, you know, French culture was imposed, far from it. I mean, you know, I'm following in the footsteps here of historians like Issa Kadri, for example, as well, who says, well, to say that the French imposed French culture on Algeria is to follow the propaganda of the Mission Civilisatrice. It did nothing of the sort. It barely touched a lot of people in all kinds of ways on that kind of cultural or linguistic level or educational level.
It's really fascinating. And I don't, Nick, I don't want to, you know, make you account for the title of the chapter in some kind of interrogatory way, but, you know, you brought up our ancestors, the Gauls, and, you know, the chapter title, Nos Ancêtres, Les Colons, kind of turns that around. But could you just sort of shed some light on, like, how exactly you're doing that? And I mean, you said it by talking about the chapter, but I'm just curious about that, the way you've turned the phrase and what you are trying to convey by that title in the case of this chapter.
Yes, I think, I mean, it connects in a way with the title of the book as a whole, which is doing a similar thing, and it's probably similarly ill-advised. I'm not sure at this stage that these were good choices. They're meant to be provocative. They're not meant to describe our relationship, you know, to this history in terms of a direct inheritance. My idea more was that by talking about our civilizing mission, or nos ancêtres les colons, that it is supposed to kind of resonate with our anxieties about what we've inherited from the colonial era, what might remain colonial about what we teach and how we teach it, and so it's a kind of the title of this chapter is really supposed to be a kind of echo of that overall the overall title of the book, and with that you know, as I say, those questions about what we imagine we've inherited and what that might tell us about what we're doing now and why we're doing it.
I'm just going to admit that I didn't catch what you're doing with the title of the book until, of course, I read the book. And then that's what's happening there. Like that.
Yeah.
I more deeply understand why the book is called what it's called. And this chapter helped me to kind of think back on that. In the third chapter, Nick, and again, this is talk about feeling implicated, teaching in a time of crisis, you know, reading this this past week, I got to that chapter and I was like, am I going to be able to handle that? It does resonate. The chapter resonated for me, just it's the title alone and some other ideas that you explore in it. But you're, of course, here, you know, focused on a particular Algerian author, critical of colonialism, but who was also an educator in that French colonial system. So can you tell us a little bit about Faoun and how you are working with that figure who I teach in my class?
Do you?
Well, the diary, you know, I teach.
Oh, yes. Okay. Diaries, yeah, yeah.
I haven't taught it in a few years, but I was thinking to myself, okay, how does this again implicate me, this chapter? How do I need to think about how I teach Faun again in the future? Anyway.
Yeah. So it focuses on Mouloud Feraoun, who was an Algerian. He was born in 1913 in a small village, in a small family. And in a sense, the book in a sense has three introductions: the introduction, the sort of historical framing, and the sort of framing through Said. In a sense, this is when I get to the kind of core material at last. And so he's an example of one of these people who was taken out of his home culture and his home background through education and transformed. And, you know, so an example then, to come back to that sort of starting point, the idea that colonial education is an example of education, of someone who's transformed by education, which is kind of what we want education to do as educators, albeit, you know, in contexts that make it much less fraught than it was for him and less painful than it was for him. Now, he moved away physically for a while in order to train and so on. But he chose to go back to his home region to teach in small villages, stayed there for as long as he could. He eventually got posted elsewhere. And then in the meantime, he started writing, and he wrote his first novel, Le Fils du Pauvre. He wrote it in the late 40s. It was more or less finished by about 1948. He had trouble getting it published. He self-published it effectively in 1950. It won a prize. It then got picked up by Seuil, the big prestigious Parisian publishing house. And so the second version of it came out in 1954, which is the one that's well known now. The 1950 edition is quite a rare book. The English translation that came out a few years back now is a translation of that first edition, of the first version, I should say. Now, that novel is not, along with his subsequent novels, is not really overtly political. There's a politics in his writing, in that he's writing about daily life in a Kabul village, for example. And, you know, in a sense, he's quite ironic about it at times, but there's also a fundamental level in which he's kind of dignifying it and exploring it. And that was still quite an innovative thing to do at this time, say, especially in the late 40s when he's writing this. There weren't many people doing that. There's almost no one doing that. So I think there's a positive politics to that, but it's not anti-colonial. And people who know him only through that novel or subsequent novels often think of him as quite an assimilated figure, quite an apolitical figure. But in 1955, a year after the beginning of the War of Independence, as we would now date it, he started keeping a diary, which, as you say, you've been teaching, which is this amazing document about his life during the war, and during which he's still teaching. And continuing to teach during the War of Independence meant that his life was at threat from both sides. That, you know, there was a boycott of French schools at one point organized by the FLN. There was a tendency, again, completely understandable, for anti-colonial nationalists to think, well, French schools are a tool of colonialism, so if you work for them, you're working against us. So there was a threat, understandably, from that side. There was also increasingly a threat from the other side, because among the settler population and among their, the conservative settler population and their allies in sort of in the military and in the pro-colonial administration, there was a feeling that any Algerian who was working in a French school teaching young Algerian children was likely to be pouring anti-French propaganda into their ears. So then they, you know, getting threats from that side as well. And then, so as you will know, in the end he was assassinated by the OAS, the Organisation Armée Secrète, this extreme right paramilitary pro-colonial organization, very few days before the signing of the Evian Accords and the final ceasefire. And his diary tracks things right up to that moment. And so I think it's an amazing story. I think the diary is a wonderful and very moving document. And what I wanted to explore in that chapter, in a sense, was his commitment to education, why he, when he was quite a successful writer, could have done other things by that point. I'm not saying it would have been easy for him to earn his living from writing, but nonetheless, there would have been ways out for him, but he remained committed to it. And it's a question about how we understand that, and how we think of his commitment to remain as an educator rather than, for example, joining the anti-colonial struggle. you know, which again, I'd see a little sort of echo here back to what I was saying about Said and the role of the public educator, the public intellectual. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's speculation to a degree. Of course, I've read pretty much everything he's written and tried to sort of look for understanding through that, but there's no very clear answer to it in a sense. But there is what emerges, I think, is his sense that the education he's doing has a value, even if it's compromised in some ways by its historical and political context. Mm-hmm. And that he thinks his job in the classroom, in a sense, is not to express his political views, you know, but to offer his students tools to think with and to offer them opportunities for the future. And I suppose something else I admire in his position in a way or is that it's he supports in the diary he's quite explicitly anti-colonial. So I don't know if I made that clear enough just now, right? But again, mm-hmm. you know, he's explicitly anti-colonial, explicitly in favour of independence. He's quite sceptical about the FLN in certain ways, but for reasons that now, you know, at times seem quite well-founded to me. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of anti-violence and he's anti-heroic in ways that I find quite admirable, and admirable in relation to gender politics, among other things, and admirable in relation to the sort of post-war legacy in Algeria and the sort of glorification of the Mujahideen. And in saying that, it's not necessarily, I mean, I think I'm persuaded by the argument as made by Fanon and many other people that violence was the only way, that anti-colonial violence was the only thing that was going to bring colonialism in Algeria to an end. But I think that as an educator, I've chosen a different path, which is more like Fanon's than like Fanon's.
Right.
And that, you know, I admire that anti-violent stance. I think that education is in some sense allied with that, or the kind of educational work that he was involved in. And that he sees his work as helping keep other values circulating, I mean, other educational and cultural values circulating, you know, even in the midst of a crisis, which makes many other crises look quite tame by comparison. So whenever I gave papers under this title, Teaching in Time of Crisis, people, of course, it always made people think I was going to be talking about the present moment.
Right.
And, as one could. And again, I wanted it to echo those things, but it's also, you know, I guess it gives you a sense of perspective, I suppose, on what you might be going through,
yeah.
or what I might be going through in my luxurious position.
Sadly, that title is timeless.
Yeah, absolutely.
The next chapter 4, Nick, you know, explores these other authors and figures who are so well known, especially Jabbar and Mami. Mm. And again, kind of looking at these figures who are in some ways not, maybe this can't account for all of their work or selves, but they were exposed to a French educational system, and that, you know, you're asking this question about how and why they were politicized in part by that system. So what are the answers to those questions in that chapter that you're exploring?
Yeah, I mean, I explore that question across the last two chapters, mm-hmm. really. And it's in the last one that I talk more about what they actually did in the classroom, mm-hmm. and the ways in which that might be politicizing, and also ways in which it might have offered them things, you know, that have a distance from politics in certain respects around the study of literature and so on. I mean, in this chapter, the fourth chapter, which is called Unfamiliar Worlds, it comes back partly to what I was saying earlier about how little colonial education there was really in the colonies. You know, even basic literacy, as you know, was only about 15% at the end of the colonial period, after 100-odd years of this discourse on the civilizing mission and that kind of justification. But that's basic literacy. I mean, to get to a point where you're being published by Seuil in Paris puts you in an absolutely tiny minority. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I study these literary texts with my students, I mean, I think there's a way in which if you're reading a Francophone novel from Algeria, what you might expect to see is an account of this kind of constant interaction and a kind of métissage and a hybrid culture and so on. Whereas what you often see when you you start reading Dibbs' Les Grandes Maisons or Ferron's Le Fils du Pauvre or something, is a sense of these kind of parallel universes, really. Mm. You know, quite a radical sense of the lack of contact between the colonized population and the settler population. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, of course, their lives may have been affected by it in all kinds of ways, but in terms of day-to-day contact, direct encounters, it seems it's often quite minimal. And then the school is the place where that often happens. And for these people, they're in schooling for longer, they go beyond primary level and so on, obviously, to reach the point that they did. And partly what it's reflecting on then is their experiences of being in a tiny minority, you know, in large schools amongst other students who are from European settler backgrounds, and how uncomfortable that often is. And I mean, one of the stories in here is drawn from Djebar's Nul part dans la maison de mon père, which is one of her final texts and one of the most sort of straightforwardly autobiographical, where she talks about this experience of being in the refectory, and how in this school, which she says, you know, was supposedly secular, in the refectory, the dining hall, Christian feast days would be quite regularly marked by serving charcuterie or choucroute or various things that involved pork. Mm-hmm. And then when Djebar came into the room, they'd say, oh, you should go off to the table for the Muslim girls today. So she's being this politicized, racialized identity being offered to her, irrespective of whether she was a practicing Muslim, whether or not she, you know, irrespective of what her dietary habits were. And they sort of rebel on this occasion, her and these other young girls, and say that they're fed up with getting worse food on those days. You know, they're getting fried eggs and the others are getting meat, and that's not good enough. But it brings a whole lot of things to light, I think, about the sort of, I mean, it's a sense in which when the French, when the people in the school say, oh, it's this sort of, you know, we're having charcuterie today, you need to go off to the other table, they're trying to accommodate them in a sense. They're trying to tolerate them. but in a way that alienates them and distances them, you know, makes them feel that they're the ones who have to be kind of, for whom allowances must be made. It raises questions about the kind of Christian cultural foundations of French secularism. You know, it's not by accident that pork is served. It's not by accident that there are holidays at Easter and Christmas. Mm-hmm. You know, that Sunday's not a school day, et cetera, et cetera. The school is secular in real senses, and serving pork isn't actually a Christian ritual. You know, you can say it's secular in that sense. Yeah. But it functions in a way that marginalizes the Muslim pupils, groups them together, gives them a politicized identity, and doesn't see in all of this that it's not allowing an Islamic or Islamicate culture to function in that sort of diffuse way. So it's a way into talking about the kind of the general culture of the school, I suppose. And again, of course, I do all of this thinking that it has all kinds of resonances in relation to laïcité in contemporary France as well, although I don't talk a lot about the hijab here, but I hope it's got obvious resonances in relation to that.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly did for me as a reader when you bring these things up. And, you know, as you kind of move towards the end of the book, you know, the discussion of, well, literature throughout, but then what the specificity of teaching the French language. And then, you close the book with this sort of question about, and it's, again, it's the subtitle of the book meant something different to me once I was done. The idea of the lessons of colonial education. I mean, there's like, Nick, the levels that are here. There are the lessons internal to colonial education as a system, but then there are the ways that, you know, come back has where to where we started about, you know, how this book is a book about colonial education as a form of education and what it gives us in terms of its potential for our thinking about, you know, the function of education more broadly outside the colonial context, in the post-colonial context, which includes, I mean, all of us everywhere, not just in Algeria or France, but, you know, if we're talking even about that relationship that includes Algeria and post-colonial Algeria and post-colonial France, as well as other parts of the former and current French Empire. This is not really a question that I'm asking, but, you know, just in terms of that conclusion about education's impact, you know, how you think about what to do with what you've explored in this book in relationship to questions of education in a more contemporary context. Something you raised earlier about, you know, the speaking of crisis, the humanities, you know, the canon, like all of these things that I am, and I think you are too, if my UK Twitter is correct, you are all also having these conversations. Yeah, how the lessons of the book for you as a scholar, for you as an educator, for you as somebody who thinks politically and acts politically in the world, like where do you end up by the end of the book?
Well, I mean,
small question.
I could link that back. I mean, another reason I chose that the title of Civilizing Mission is that I start off with an essay in the introduction by George Steiner called "To Civilize Our Gentlemen," which is a quotation from Matthew Arnold. So again, it's got an echo with a longer history and with the role of education. And he talks about the sense of crisis in the humanities. And this is published in 1965, so it's quite a while ago now. And he talks about the foundations of the literary disciplines, English, you know, particularly as studied in Britain or in an English-speaking country, and then French in France and so on. And he talks about the relationship to the classics, which is not, you know, something sort of particular concern to me here. He talks about its relationship to nationalism. And then he talks about the third founding assumption as he sees it beyond this, the close relationship to the classic, which is largely eroded. And then the relationship to nationalism. The third thing is something to do with the kind of, you know, improving impact of great books on the people who read them. Now, I mean, one of the big issues in this book, of course, is the issue around nationalism, and that still runs so deep through educational systems, and it, you know, it crops up again and again. You see this in France. We've had it here again recently in Britain, you know, an insistence on what kind of history gets taught, the idea that British values should be promoted, which, you know, means supposed to mean a whole set of positive things, of course. There were, you know, one could debate what British values are and have been and so on. And so it's made me think more about that and about how hard it is actually to extricate oneself from that. I mean, the very existence of something like a French department relies on this notional alignment of a language, a literature, and a nation. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to sort of put inverted commas around the first two A's there. I mean, you can say what a nation is, and that, of course, that's problematic in all kinds of ways, but it does have borders around it in a way that the language and the literature don't. The idea of countable, separate literatures aligned with national identities, you know, seems increasingly absurd to me, as it does to a lot of people. So that's one thing I think it's made me think about more, and how one moves beyond that, especially again in the case of working in something like a French department, where on some level I still like the idea of teaching the cultural material and the language together and promoting the study of the language that I say is foreign for most of my students, if not for all of them. The title Education's Impact is also a bit of a nod to the UK context, where you'll be familiar perhaps with the research assessment exercise in its current incarnation known as the REF. And there are a set of requirements when our research is assessed centrally every few years, which is associated with university funding. An additional criterion was introduced, not in this current round, but in the last one, to do with impact, which was showing ways in which your research had had influence outside the academy, essentially. I mean, you know, it's getting a longish short story short. And I suppose part of what I wanted to do here was to kind of reassert as absolutely fundamental and central to what we do, the relationship between our teaching and what we write about. So I suppose there's a level on which, you know, much as I like the idea of influencing people outside the academy and have sought to do that, you know, in various ways in my life and even within my career in a sense, What's central to me is the relationship between all this time I spend reading and thinking about these things and what I do in the classroom. I reach more people in that way than I'm ever likely to reach through my publications, Frank. So it's reasserting that, but that does involve then a recommitment to the kind of education that I'm involved in, you know. And so it's a chance to try and think, what is it in this educational system, which is compromised in various ways politically in my context as well, what is it that I still believe in this? I don't believe in nationalism. I don't think that what I'm doing has a sort of close and living link to the classics. And so it does bring you back to something that, for which we now struggle to find a vocabulary, which is the benefits of the encounter with the text that we choose. And I suppose, I mean, if I can just make one final sort of specific point about that, I suppose it's brought home to me that I don't really want to teach anything where my own mind is completely made up about it, least of all if it's something that I think, you know, should be sort of dismissed. And, you know, so I suppose because it's made me more conscious of the fact I'm choosing how my students will spend their time, and that they'll spend a lot more time with the books or even with the films than they do with me, and that I've got to think in some sense that I'm doing them a favor by getting them to read this stuff that they might not otherwise have read, mm-hmm. and that it's educationally positive, that encounter in itself. And so that's made me think about how and why I choose the things I do, and brings me back also to some of those issues that I was thinking about, you know, back in earlier work as well, about what the specific values associated with literature and with film and so on might be, and why you might want to study them alongside history, alongside politics, or on their own at a certain point. Mm-hmm. It's helped me to think about the teaching of music from this point of view as well. I'm going off on a real tangent now, but it seems to me that the justification for teaching literature, the most ready vocabulary for that now for many of us is political, but I think I should be able to come up with a model where it also seems to me still legitimate for people to spend their time studying music and making music. Mm-hmm. Should I mean that and that has a kind of a value that persists whatever else is going on?
I hope you won't take this the wrong way, because I mean it as a compliment, but you know, among the many things that I didn't expect to find in the book is, like, it sort of worked as self-help for me, you know, like, especially at this time. I mean, it's not that it's just in the past year that I've been thinking about, like, what my role is as an educator and the choices that I make, but I mean, I'm always thinking about that, but more than I ever thought I would in graduate school. I just didn't really think about what I was being trained. I mean, it wasn't what I was being trained to do, it was to be a teacher. And then of course you get a job and your life is entirely, almost entirely, at least mine was, you know, consumed by trying to figure out how to be a teacher. And so, yeah, the things that you've just said now, and then reading the book, those broader questions that come out of the meditations on these authors and the colonial context and that colonial education system. And just, yeah, I really, this is a bit of a journey for me reading your book, and not, it's not really a question there either, Nick, but it's just more that, yeah, I just wasn't expecting that this would be as on point as it was for picking up a book for this podcast during the pandemic. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm really pleased to hear that, because there's a level on which, again, I've tried to deal with the history kind of scrupulously and to say things about that, but in a way, the, you know, talk about the lessons of colonial education, but it's supposed to be, you know, heuristic and not didactic. It's supposed to get people thinking about these things, but also at a certain point feeling, yeah, kind of recommitting to the teaching, I suppose that's where I wanted to end up. For me, you know, it's supposed to be beneficial for me from that point of view too, mm-hmm. but connects with the fact that, and again, this link back to the Saeed in some ways, I think that I enjoy writing and thinking, but it's not always easy for me to believe that that's a good way to spend my time. Whereas I think with teaching, I always do believe that, even though I'm aware of the ways in which it's compromised in certain respects, even though I'm aware that I'm involved, among other things, in a mechanism of social reproduction and so on in certain respects. And there are all kinds of problems with that. Mm-hmm. But there's a core in it in which I keep confidence, you know, and that in a very oblique and you know unstraightforward way I was trying to kind of re-articulate through this work.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nick, there are loads of questions that I would love to keep asking you about, and things I want to keep talking to you about, but and I will, outside the context of this interview. That sounds kind of like a threat, doesn't it? Like, be warned that this conversation will continue after this interview, but I'll ask you one more within the confines of the interview, which is, what are you working on now? I mean, I know that it's been a really rough year, but what do you think you'll work on next?
So I'm not someone who's highly prolific, and I don't even know if I'm going to write another big book, as it were. I tend, if I do, it'll be because I do some smaller things first. I mean, there are spin-offs from this. I mean, I've been writing something. One of the ideas that comes up is the idea of adaptation in relation to that, you know, that I phrase about nos ancêtres les Gaulois, and how far you change your material depending on who's in your classroom. You know, at the level of, and you know, quite what that means is a big question, of course, already, because this is, you know, is it the level of the individual, is it the level of the kind of overall demographic, etc., etc. So I'm interested in thinking about that more, and in relation to contemporary France as well. And I've been coming at that actually through film, partly through Comté's Entre les Murs and Cochise's L'Esquive, and I even thought of calling it the civilizing Mission Comes Home, but then I thought I've had enough of that particular provocation, so it's going to have a different title. But that's one thing. I'm interested in doing more around Ferraun, partly because it's just a kind of footnote in the book, but I started studying these textbooks that he produced towards the end of the colonial era. So this was the moment when I finally did something that would be recognised as archival research by a historian, I think. So they're hard to get hold of, and there's a set of teachers' books as well as the textbooks, a series of four, which started being published in the colonial era and before he died, obviously, and then they finished being published posthumously, but still with his name on. Mm-hmm. And they give quite an interesting insight into, you know, into what he was trying to do, but how teaching was thought of at that time and the uses that were made of literature. And it's actually a surprisingly, extremely demanding and highly eclectic corpus that he and his co-authors assembled for, what, you know, for use in primary schools. And it's pretty extraordinary. So that's quite a, you know, it's a very tightly focused project in a way, but with all kinds of interesting questions about what we study in world literature and so on. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in doing more around colonial education and maybe collaboratively, you know, I'm working across history and literature, and, you know, through micro histories and through that emphasis on the sort of the lived experience of colonialism, but working in teams in such ways as to kind of join up those micro histories into more of a chronological narrative as well, maybe.
Well, I'm excited to hear about all of that. Nick, I just want to thank you so much for speaking about this book and for writing it.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me about it. I've enjoyed it.